I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last month marked the first anniversary of the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act. It was touted as legislation that would curb the risky and dangerous Wall Street practices that led to the financial collapse of a few years ago and the recession that followed. Many of the more than 300 new rules are still being written 1 year later, and there are efforts in Congress to delay, derail, and defund some parts of Dodd-Frank. We begin our conversation with Ted Kaufman, former U.S. Senator from Delaware, currently chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel overseeing TARP. That's the Troubled Assets Relief Program. And Ted Kaufman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty.
And I do want to get to your critique, and you have a number of them, but has Dodd-Frank done anything to prevent a future financial meltdown?
Well, that's pretty sweeping. I'm sure there are things that have been done. I think they've done almost 40 rules now, so they're doing things. But in terms of the big problems that were identified, not much. And it's got very slow going and very questionable whether they'll ever get to the end of the road.
And one of those big problems, as you have identified, is this too big to fail, the idea of breaking up these big banks. Where do we stand on that issue?
I just think we're, you know, just exactly what a lot of us said on the floor, and that is that, you know, we should have put rules into the Dodd-Frank. As you remember, Marty, after the great crash in the 1920s, they had a PCORA commission that sat down and actually wrote the law, the Glass-Steagall law, which set up the FDIC, set a lot of rules for everything else. This time with Dodd-Frank, we decided to go a different way. Not we, but the Congress did. And my argument was they should have put in place those rules. In fact, the biggest rule in that was the Glass-Steagall Act, which was repealed in 1999. And for all the time it was in existence, we didn't have these kind of problems. So essentially, they should have actually put into the law what the rules were. They gave the regulators almost 400 rules. And the banking lobbyists, $215 million they spent last year. They spent over $50 million in the first quarter this year. The regulators are just stuck with hundreds of rules to write, and I'd say the vast majority of the pressure coming from Wall Street and the bank community.
How would you, though, then rewrite Glass-Steagall to fit, you know, 2011 and beyond?
Just write it just the way it was. It was fine from 1999. There's no argument that Glass-Steagall wasn't working. It was we had a position in this country held by a number of people, mostly in the Republican Party, that said we should just free markets. In fact, you hear them talking about it even now. We don't need any regulation. That was the whole argument. Why do we have to regulate? And as you know, under Glass-Steagall, what happened, there were two kinds of banks. You could be a bank that was a commercial bank, like most of us do our banking, our checking, and the rest of it, and you had FDIC insurance. And that was to make sure that people stopped taking things and planting in their backyard, their money, and actually bring it in. It worked great from when it was passed in 1933 to 1999. There were other banks called investment banks, which dealt with high-risk investments, which is the high-risk investments got us all in trouble. What happened is Glass-Steagall allowed banks, big banks, to get into both businesses. So the people were being government insured on their balances, which gave them incredible flexibility, but they still were involved in these very high-risk derivatives and credit default obligations and all the other things that just went awry. So that's the first step we should have done, was reinstitute Glass-Steagall.
But does that mean that if they are engaging in some of these risky and dangerous practices and get themselves in trouble, that the government will be forced to bail them out, to step in and bail them out?
Well, S&P just came out with something earlier this year where they basically say yes. I mean, when you read the language of their statement, they basically say they still believe that, you know, in trouble these banks. Well, and the banks are massive, as you know, Marty. I mean, mm-hmm. They went 15 years ago, they were 17% of the total assets in the United States. Their assets were the total percentage of the gross domestic product. Today it's 63-64%. These banks are massive. And what we did, here we had this incredible problem. Mm-hmm. We had too big to fail. What do? In order to get out of the problem, we took Merrill Lynch and put it Countrywide and put it in the Bank of America. We put Wachovia into Wells Fargo. We put Washington Mutual and Bear Stearns into J.P. Morgan Chase to make these gigantic banks even more gigantic.
Do you blame, though? I mean, are you saying it's the lobbying efforts on the part of the financial industry that is, in a sense, kind of defanged what was supposed to be Dodd-Frank and an effort to prevent future collapse?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, that's part of the problem. Part of the problem is the way we wrote the law, and we allowed the regulators to do it. We should have stepped up to the ball. The other thing, Marty, is just think about it. If you're in the Congress and you won't step up to the ball and make the tough decisions, then you pass to the regulators. Where most of these regulatory bodies are, you know, bodies that have, like, you know, the Securities Exchange Commission has 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans. Well, 2 Republicans haven't changed their opinion about the fact we shouldn't be doing anything. They still believe in these free markets. So what you have is these agencies out there, the Office of Control of the Currency and these others, that are it's very difficult for them to make the tough decisions. And then you have a different theory, you know, different theories of how we should be doing this. So it was clear we had these problems. But when you look at, especially when you, after a year later, you look at the whole thing a year later and you look back on what was the problems and that created this thing and what we've done about it, it is very, very little.
You talk about we in Congress, and at that point you were a U.S. senator for a little time.
Yes.
Is that a bipartisan we?
No, primarily, basically, if you look at the votes on most of the important legislation, it was all the Republicans voted against everything. Then you had some Democrats support the Republicans. So, it's fair to say that, I mean, obviously it passed, so it had bipartisan support, because the Democrats had at that time 58, 59, 60 votes. So clearly it was a bipartisan decision, and there are Democrats who believe, you know, we don't need regulation. I don't understand that. You hear these arguments about regulation to make it sound so strange, but regulation is just like having police officers on the beat to keep crime from happening. Regulation is the referees on the football field to make sure the players obey the rules.
One of the critiques, though, of Dodd-Frank is that there are too many regulations and that they're spread across a number of agencies and that it's confusing, maybe onerous.
Absolutely right. And that's why I went back in the beginning to talk about the PCORA Commission and what the Senate, what the Congress did in 1933. They laid down what the rules were going to be. The regulators still have to enforce the rules, but they laid down what are the capital requirements that banks should have. What are the rules we're going to have on derivatives? How are we going to deal with this problem with Glass-Steagall? They laid it all out. They didn't like throw out the regulators. The regulators have a full-time job just regulating the rules after you make them.
Because in Dodd-Frank, the framework was passed on, was approved, and it was up to the regulators then to write the rules.
Right. If you go and look on the floor, there were a number of us on the floor speaking at the time saying this is a bad way to go. You cannot pass. If we're not willing to make the tough decisions, how can you expect the regulators? To be honest with you, I had no idea how bad it would actually turn out to be. Because the battle, as you say, I mean, it's not all, you know, the Wall Street lobbyists, but it's a big portion of Wall Street lobbyists. And the problem is there isn't much on the other side. When you look at how the money is being spent to lobby on this Dodd-Frank, the vast majority is being spent by Wall Street. Very little. There's just not the kind of money. The consumer groups and everything else don't have that kind of money. And there are very few people, frankly, that want to take on the big banks because they're so big and powerful.
And what about the regulation of derivatives? Where does that stand?
That stands that on, I think it was July 16th, the Commodities Future Trading Commission was supposed to come out with rules. They now say it's going to be 6 months.
Because it takes, what, time to write these rules, or just because of what we've been talking?
It takes time. There are processes that they have to go through, but I think part of it is it's just incredibly difficult. There was a story in one of the newspapers. They said that the CFTC lobby, literally the lobby where the CFTC is, used to be kind of empty, and ever since this bill passed, it's just packed every day with lobbyists. And these, by the way, when I say lobbyists, I'm not talking about people who are buying anything else. I'm talking about people who come in and make very reasoned, very thoughtful, very difficult arguments for a regulator to deal with.
The Consumer Financial Protection Board, Elizabeth Warren actually was passed over by President Obama.
Right.
Richard Cordray has been nominated to head up this board. Do you have any confidence that this board will be functional and that even Cordray can be approved by Congress?
No.
No?
No. I don't see it. They've not confirmed anybody else, so I don't see why they would confirm him. They basically said, and this is not, you know, it's like I find myself more and more on these issues quoting Patrick Moynihan. Everybody has a right to their own opinion, but they don't have a right to their own facts. The fact is that 44 Republicans wrote and said, we're not going to approve anybody until you change the structure of the CFPB, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. So that's already been said. The Bureau is in existence, but the problem is that rulemaking, you can't make rules without a director, and Republicans have blocked, they won't go into recess to allow the president to make a recess appointment of Cordray or of Elizabeth Warren or of anybody else. So it's just basically it's blocking all the wrong way. And they've got people on the actually on the Republican side, on the House side, writing letters to the Securities Exchange Commission, the other commissions, just kind of daring them to make any changes at all, especially with the CF. They're not going to move forward out of the CFPB. And they're also cutting the amount of money that the regulators have, or trying to cut the money that they have to implement the rules.
But do you think there's anything the president can do or say to try to get approval for this head of this committee?
There are a number of things, and he has. He was quite outspoken when he appointed Cordray, who's an excellent choice, by the way. I mean, Elizabeth Warren clearly would have been. I mean, she invented the thing, and she's great, and she would be absolutely the best person to do it. But the Republicans early on said there's no way that they were going to confirm her. But I don't think they're ready really to confirm anybody. I just don't think they like the Consumer Finance Protection Board. They surely didn't vote for it when it was up, and now that that they can block it, and now they control the House. They're going to block anything that the president does on this issue. But remember, and again, I'm not defending the president. The president can defend himself. But look at the array of things that the president has to speak on these days.
Well, that's true enough. But you are the chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel overseeing TARP.
No, that has expired.
Oh, that has expired. Oh, you're former chair.
I have since expired.
Since expired, but yes. but we read your piece in Huffington Post. I mean, is that your platform in coming on radio shows? Is that what you're left with?
Well, I'm not. Frankly, I'm not running for anything. I'm not trying to get a job. I'm just trying to speak to these issues, and basically say, you know, there is some credibility for the fact if you say something's going to happen and then it happens. That maybe the cause that you suggested why it didn't happen is the cause why it didn't happen, if you know what I mean.
Well,
so I'm just very concerned about it. I'm very, very concerned. And Marty, it doesn't come from some, you know, left-wing liberal approach. I think fair to say left to center. It comes to the fact that we have went through something that just hurt so many Americans. I mean, it's just, to me, as you can tell, I mean, you get emotional about it. What Americans are going through right now in terms of jobs and housing and everything you read about, especially the middle class and the poor, have gone through, it's just awful. And the idea that we're sitting here a year after this horror has happened, still arguing about the arguments we had 5 years ago about whether this could ever happen, it happened. Mm. And the fact that it could happen again is just, you know, it goes to the core of the pain to all the people that are going through it, and it goes to the point is, can this country survive another approach? And then, frankly, I don't see many interest in Wall Street, just like there wasn't much interest in what they did before, to do anything about it. In fact, they're very set to just keep making the money and keep it coming in. As long as it lasts, that's great, and if it goes down at the end, you know, it doesn't really hurt them because they're gone and they got the bonuses.
Well, on that note, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times, getting our conversation started. Ted Kaufman, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Former U.S. Senator from Delaware and former chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel overseeing TARP. We will carry on this conversation with another guest waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Master's in Writing Studies at St. Joseph's University supports WHYY, created for both business and creative writers. This full or part-time program aims to fill the gap between traditional English and creative writing degrees. Practicing writers and published authors lead small classes to encourage ideation and collaboration. Information to register for the open house on Tuesday, August 9th from 5 to 7 at sju.edu/higher-knowledge. Graduate studies at SJU. Higher knowledge, higher potential.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM, or listen online at whyy.org and newsworks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow NewsWorks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
From Public Radio International, I'm Jackie Larden. On the next America Abroad, European disunion.
Europe is still unfinished in a way. The currency is still under pressure. And if something happens, the whole system could perhaps fall apart.
Could the current debt crisis bring an end to Europe as we know it?
Tomorrow night at 11 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. The Dodd-Frank Act was passed and signed by President Obama last summer, hailed as the most sweeping reform of the financial system since the Depression and one that would prevent another meltdown. We're talking about where the country stands when it comes to financial reform. Have those risky Wall Street practices been curbed? Are the new regulations too onerous? Is the public better off than they were before Dodd-Frank? And joining us now is Jesse Eisinger. He's a senior reporter for ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. He writes a regular column for the New York Times Deal Book section. This year, he won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting with Jake Bernstein for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices that helped to make the financial crisis. And Jesse Eisinger, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Let's see if we can get him up.
All right. Can you hear me?
I can now. That was okay. A pregnant pause. And Jesse Eisinger, thank you so much. First of all, congratulations on the Pulitzer, and thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks a lot. Happy to be here.
Well, I know you were listening to Ted Kaufman, and he ended. I mean, one can hear the frustration, the passion, frankly, the anger in his voice. He mentioned the actual cost of the financial crisis when it comes to things like jobs and wealth and the various hits to the economy. Can you, in a sense, sort of summarize the impact of that financial meltdown on the country today?
Well, sure. We wiped out trillions of dollars of wealth in housing wealth and securities holdings, stock market wealth. The stock market plummeted. And then we lost major financial institutions. A lot of financial institutions were absorbed into new financial institutions, as Senator Kaufman said. Bear Stearns failed, Lehman Brothers failed. This caused banks to tighten up their lending, so people had a harder time getting loans. Then had a crisis in the real economy with the big three automakers. The financial crisis cost millions of jobs and trillions of dollars of losses in wealth.
And has it highlighted, in a sense, the divide between Wall Street and what's called Main Street in this country?
It certainly has. One of the things we've seen is how much the economy has become financialized in the last several decades. The financial sector went from being an intermediary. You know, you stand between a borrower or a lender. You stand between one person who wants to sell and one person who wants to buy a stock or a bond, into something that was self-perpetuating, that funded itself and grew and became a much bigger part of the economy, and distorted income, was a brain drain. Physicists, biochemists, computer scientists left the economy to go work at hedge funds and Wall Street investment banks. They were lured there by the enormous outsized salaries that you could get on Wall Street. And then to this day, we have banks earning huge profits because of the way the government has treated the banks and saved the banks in order to get the economy going again. But what those efforts have really failed. So what we've had is big banks making record profits, restoring huge bonuses to Wall Street investment bankers, but the rest of the economy still is suffering.
There's much about the excesses of Wall Street that's frustrating, but I think what's also frustrating is that no one seems to have been held liable or even responsible for what was done to the country.
Yeah, that's pretty shocking and very confusing. One of the things clearly that has not happened is that no major Wall Street executive was held to account in any significant way. There were a small handful of fines. Angelo Mozzillo, the CEO of Countrywide, was fined a somewhat large amount, tens of millions of dollars, but his bank paid for most of it, and he didn't face any prospect of prison. And he had made hundreds of millions of dollars as CEO, so it was really a small portion of his overall compensation. Otherwise, no major executive has faced any prospect of prison or jail time when there were clearly multiple instances of deeply questionable practices that bordered, at least you could argue, on fraudulent behavior, misrepresentations from major CEOs about the state of their business, and questionable trades. So I think that the fact that that was not fully investigated by the Department of Justice and even the Securities and Exchange Commission is a real shame and a deep problem, because I think people see on Main Street, Wall Street getting away with it.
And from your reporting, do you know why the SEC, why the Justice Department was not more aggressive in going after some of these individuals?
Yeah, I think there are multiple reasons. One is a resource question. They didn't put enough resources to enforcement action. They didn't build big task forces. You know, there should have been a Lehman Brothers task force. There should have been a Bear Stearns task force. There should have been a structured finance task force. And the little task forces would compete with each other to make prosecutions. So you'd set up some not only would you dedicate people to specific banks or specific themes, but they would also want to make cases to better their colleagues. So that was completely lacking. Then there was an attitudinal problem that pervaded government, and I think that was that the financial system is so fragile that we can't hurt people's confidence now, and so we can't really aggressively prosecute these people because people would lose faith. I think that's completely wrong-headed, but I think that is today continues to be the sort of Timothy Geithner, our Treasury Secretary's ethos about the financial sector, that we need to constantly be worried about investor confidence and try to put a brave face on things. And that was a big problem undermining any investigative efforts.
Ted Kaufman mentioned the millions of dollars that have been spent in lobbying. Do you think that also influenced whoever was supposed to investigate what was going on in Wall Street? Is there any way to connect those dots?
Yeah, I don't see any direct connection necessarily. I mean, the indirect, you know, I think the lobbying is about the new rules surrounding Dodd-Frank. Mm-hmm. I think that the correlated phenomenon is that Wall Street investment bankers hire extremely expensive, extremely smart lawyers. And these cases are very difficult to make. I mean, you can't be so cavalier as to say that a case about a structured finance product is going to be a slam dunk for the SEC or the DOJ. Lots of lawyers signed off on these deals. They were accompanied by hundreds of pages of financial disclosures. And they were mostly sophisticated investors buying and selling from sophisticated investors. So in that scenario where everybody is lawyered up from the get-go, you have a lot of plausible reasons why that was not necessarily fraudulent or wasn't a bad action on your part, or you were doing something that your lawyers told you to do. So these cases are extremely hard to make. And so, you know, these guys have a lot of resources, not only to have relied on them while these deals were being done, but also they can rely on them now to go in and persuade the lawyers at the DOJ or the SEC that there's no case here.
Let me segue from that to Dodd-Frank. And as you have written, Dodd-Frank requires 387 different rules from 20 different regulatory agencies. The legislation runs more than 2,000 pages. And as we have heard from Ten Kaufman and from your reporting and from others, many of those rules are still being written by regulators. Is Dodd-Frank almost too complex and too sprawling to address any of the issues it's supposed to address?
It's funny. On the one hand, it's enormously ambitious and complex, and on the other hand, it was very deeply unambitious. There's no big structural change either to the financial system or the regulatory architecture of this country. Dodd-Frank doesn't call for anything remotely analogous to what we did in the wake of the Great Depression in the 1930s when we created Glass-Steagall to split investment banking and commercial banking, to create the 33 and 34 acts, which created the SEC created FDIC insurance and all these other major structural reforms. And Dodd-Frank, for all of its sprawl, does none of that. In fact, you know, we have more or less the same regulatory agencies that we had to begin with the exception of a small and completely forlorn agency, the Office of Thrift Supervision, that was totally captured by the industry that it supposedly regulated. That has been folded into the current banking regulators, but we have a new regulator, the Consumer Financial Protection Board. So you know, we didn't lose any. We still have this alphabet soup situation, and we still largely have the financial system that we had going into it. So, you know, there was a lack of structural change that I think is problematic.
And that's Jesse Eisinger. He's a senior reporter for ProPublica, covering Wall Street and finance. This year, he won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting with Jake Bernstein for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. A few weeks after the first anniversary of Dodd-Frank, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Do give us a call. You had an interesting piece actually in ProPublica saying, and I'm looking at the headlines here, once unthinkable breakup of big banks now seem feasible. And the article is about how people that own stock, I guess, in some of the big banks want a better return, and maybe they'll do more to break up the big banks than the government would do.
Yeah, I think that breaking up the big banks is a part of the solution toward having a safer financial system. Congress punted on it. The regulators wouldn't do it. Now, the question that I had was, these stocks are performing very poorly, and investors are quite worried about them. And investors don't like that these institutions are huge, unwieldy, extremely difficult to manage, and untransparent. You can't really understand their financial position from looking at their voluminous SEC filings. You can look at their balance sheet, but you don't actually know their exposure. And so the question is, you know, is JP Morgan, which is relatively well managed, does it make sense that it is a bank that has credit cards and provides commercial loans and also does investment banking services and then also does back office processing of securities and has asset management businesses? These are all different disparate businesses that don't necessarily have any connection with each other. So we could potentially have a stock market solution here, not a perfect solution, in fact, a deeply imperfect solution in many ways, but a solution that would make these banks smaller, and smaller is inherently more manageable and safer, I think.
So the idea that investors obviously wanting performance, wanting to make money, would look to some of these smaller banks, seeing that as a better investment?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Bank of America is trading at half of its book value, which means that investors, book value is a key measure of the value of a bank, and it's just simply its assets minus its liabilities. And investors see that the assets minus its liabilities $1, and they're willing to pay 50 cents for that $1 today, mm-hmm. which means that they're deeply skeptical about the value of that asset, that whether Bank of America is representing that value correctly. So what Bank of America could do is raise money, raise capital to say, recognize this. And one thing they could do to raise capital is sell Merrill Lynch, the investment bank that they bought. That would provide a lot of cash to Bank of America. They wouldn't sell stocks. So they wouldn't dilute the existing stockholders. And from a societal point of view, you know, I don't care about stock market investor returns particularly, but if there's an overlap between society's interest and the stock market, that's, you know, in my view, a good thing. And the stock market investors might be happy. And from a societal point of view, you'd have an investment bank out of this giant commercial bank, and therefore the investment bank wouldn't be subsidized by FDIC insurance.
Interesting. In our convoluted banking system, and I understand exactly what you're saying. Let me get Sam from Ardmore
That's
to join.
That's good.
Because it is complicated.
It is complicated, yeah.
But we're doing okay here. Let me get Sam from Ardmore to join our conversation. And Sam, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Thank you. Thank you very much. Very interesting discussion. My opinion about Dodd-Frank is that it's actually not as targeted or surgical with respect to the actual problems of the financial crisis as it should have been. And because of that, the regulators are swamped with writing, you know, numerous rules that really have nothing to do with the financial crisis. And if I could just make one more comment and then get your reaction. Related to community banks, Mr. Eisinger just said how it's better to have, you know, more smaller banks. Ironically, or perhaps not ironically, a lot of the smaller banks will not be able to deal with a lot of the regulations that they've are now facing through Dodd-Frank, and you'll actually see, I think, consolidation into larger banks because of that, which is exactly what we don't need.
Well, that's interesting. Sam, let me give Jesse Eisinger a chance to respond. And he's saying essentially that it's hastily written and not really addressing the problems in the banking industry.
Yeah, well, I'll take that last point that he made about community banks first, which is that regulators don't like lots of small banks. They think it makes their job harder because I think it's because they have to travel to more than one place. And so they would like consolidation in the banking industry, which is exactly wrong in my view. I think we should have a proliferation of lots of small banks. That isn't to say that lots of small banks can't get into the exact same business and fail at the exact same time. We saw that in the Great Depression. We saw that in the S&L crisis. But I think that you can stop it more quickly if you have good regulators and lots of small banks. As for Dodd-Frank not being precise enough or focused on the actual causes of the financial crisis, I'm not totally in agreement there. I think that it focuses on derivatives, which were a big part of the financial crisis. Mm-hmm. It focuses on trying to create a resolution authority where we would have a will, a living will for banks, and the banks would have to say, here's how you would break us up in a very short period of time if we got it into big trouble. And this would be a way that you would ding our stockholders and ding our bondholders before you actually asked for money from taxpayers. That's at the heart of the crisis. And if we could do that, if we had been able to do that with Lehman Brothers, for instance, or even before that for Bear Stearns, the crisis would have looked very, very different. Now, Resolution Authority... Okay, well,
They're playing my song. Hold on to that thought, and we'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation, talking with Jesse Eisinger about financial reform. Dodd-Frank, are we better off today than we were before Dodd-Frank? And where do we stand when it comes to this important issue of financial reform? We'll take a very short break, and then we're going to come right back. So stay with us.
Einstein Healthcare Network supports WHYY. For people who suffer from chronic pain and aren't able to participate in daily activities, the Einstein Pain Institute offers specialized care in pain management. Through clinical trials, experience, and commitment to quality, Einstein addresses complex issues both to manage and relieve pain. Einstein uses a team approach to create a customized plan to meet individual needs. Einstein Healthcare Network. For more information or for an appointment, 1-800-EINSTEIN.
On the next Fresh Air, Andy Serkis describes playing an ape in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. He did it with the help of computer-generated imagery, like he did in the Lord of the Rings films playing Gollum, whose tortured voice was inspired by Serkis's cat coughing up fur balls.
You see this fur about to be chucked up, and then they sort of go...
Join us this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The Casey Anthony trial showed us that forensic science isn't magical or ironclad. One professor says jurors should see accuracy rates. Also, the attack of the Asian tiger mosquito. Vicious, hard to kill, and they bite in the daytime. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone talking with Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter for ProPublica. He's been covering Wall Street and finance, won the Pulitzer Prize this year for national reporting with his co-author Jake Bernstein for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices. Our topic for today's Radio Times, just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Jesse, did you want to add anything to what we were saying right before the break?
Sure. I mean, once you get past the structural lack of ambition in Dodd-Frank, there are three big problems, and Senator Kaufman touched on them. One was that the rules were left to regulators. Right. Two is that the funding is getting cut off at the agency, so they can't implement the rules. And then three is that some of these things may turn out to be simply totally unworkable. And resolution authority, which I was talking about earlier, is one of them, which is how do you break up Citigroup if Citigroup is on the brink of failure and try to insulate taxpayers from having to be on the hook to take it over and take first losses? And so what they've done is they said, okay, Citigroup, you have to tell us how you're going to commit suicide if you're in deep trouble and not hurt us. And, you know, make sure the bullet hits you and doesn't hit taxpayers. But it turns out that this is probably or possibly impossible because Citigroup has literally thousands of legal entities all across the world that have they're subject to their own laws, their own jurisdictions, and have capital in them to support those businesses. And what you'd want is all the capital come back to the headquarters and so that you could split it up and put the capital to work, you know, backing the assets so that taxpayers didn't have to put more capital in. That's maybe impossible. We don't know. They're working very hard on it. It's extraordinarily complex. But this is the kind of thing where Dodd-Frank said, okay, we would, in an ideal world, we'd like the power to do this. You figure it out, and nobody has figured it out right now.
Let me see what Donald from Princeton has to say. And Donald, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Great
good morning.
Show.
Thank you.
Your guest had mentioned that there was no overt impact on the regulation because of lobbying per se. Could he comment on the fact that investment banks, the large banks, typically look to the regulatory agencies to hire their talent to fend off regulatory threats? And that in and of itself probably tainted the process.
Well, that's an interesting comment. Jesse Eisinger, go ahead.
Yeah, this is an extraordinarily big problem in our regulatory structure, with the revolving door where people go from big investment banks to the SEC and back again. And occasionally it really works out where you have somebody like Gary Gensler, who heads up the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, who was a former Goldman partner and, in fact, is now either a complete zealot and convert to regulation or he always was and it's just been released. And that's good because he's very smart and has expertise in the area. But what we have mostly is a bunch of regulators who are very, very smart, hardworking but underpaid, and they see the law firms that they deal with on a regular basis that are representing the banks and lawyers and investment banks at the banks as their future. They see them as places that they'll go to work, that they'll be their future colleagues, and there's or former colleagues that they've worked with in the past. And so they're just sort of seeing the world from the banker's perspective, and they can't really help it. And this is what's called regulatory capture, and we have a big problem with that. And these problems are hard to solve. Dodd-Frank didn't solve that essential problem.
But are you saying that people are, in a sense, pulling their punches, knowing that this could be their future employer?
I think that they're, yes, to some extent, but I think that more insidiously, they're seeing the world from the banker's perspective. And these bankers are extremely reasonable and smart and thoughtful about their arguments. They don't say, I want my unfettered compensation and I don't want to pay taxes and I want to do anything I want. They say, you know, you've said that we have to be transparent in the derivatives market. Here's a clearinghouse rule that would allow for more transparency, but actually allow us to insulate us from the worst of the problems of the market, but and have taxpayers take the brunt of it if we had a big problem. You know, there are sophisticated arguments that they produce, and the regulators are open-minded and amenable to that. And part of it is that they see their future employer sitting across from them.
I asked Ted Kaufman about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He believed, based on some of the maneuvers in Congress, that this bureau would really never get up and running. It's designed to protect consumers from unscrupulous lenders and organizations confusing financial instruments. Do you share his pessimism about this agency?
Well, the agency seems to be in deep trouble, yeah. Certainly, they're Obama's desired appointee, Elizabeth Warren, was blocked, and Obama backed down from that. And now Richard Cordray, who he has appointed, also seems to be on the verge of being blocked, and particularly by Richard Shelby, who has gone from, bizarrely, sort of transformed from a pretty thoughtful, reasonable Republican to a complete partisan, anti-regulatory zealot. And it's quite a shame, and there's been relatively little attention paid to his particular willful, single-minded blocking of certain appointees. But, whether Obama eventually gets somebody through, who knows? I think that the Republicans are playing for time in Congress, where they want to, they think, after the 2012 elections, we'll really be able to gut this if we win.
Picking up on something you mentioned earlier, and we talked a bit about how the banks have been and were bailed out, but obviously the subprime mortgage crisis was so much at the heart of the financial collapse. Has that been addressed at all?
Yes. There is a sort of cat not going away, going close to the hot stove aspect to all of this, where certain risky practices and certain risky products just simply don't exist right now. It's much harder to create a collateralized debt obligation full of some subprime securities right now, which is sort of, amalgams of mortgages packaged and repackaged and sold to investors. Investors don't want to buy them. Investment banks aren't making them. The subprime market doesn't exist, essentially. It only exists with government backing right now. And so there is, in some ways, the risky practices that got us exactly into the financial crisis of 2008 have, abated to some extent. But the financial crisis is ongoing. If anybody's seen what's happening in Europe right now, we still are coming out of an extraordinarily indebted period, and we have not resolved it. And the banks, particularly in Europe, are in deep trouble.
I'm also thinking all of those homeowners that got in trouble, some underwater in houses that are worth less than their mortgage, and the fact that part of our economy hasn't been addressed in what appears to be kind of a full and effective way.
Yes, we have an ongoing deep ongoing troubling housing crisis. Mm-hmm. 20-25% of homes are underwater. People are not being able to refinance their mortgage with terms that they could afford. What we need to have banks do probably is to write down the principal of the mortgage to a point where people can stay in their homes. That would be better for the people, individuals. It would be better for the banks. It would be better for communities to have people in their homes in a way that's affordable. But it would mean deep losses to the banks, and the banks understandably want to resist that. So it would be up to regulators and lawmakers to enforce those write-downs, and lawmakers and regulators don't want to do it because that could precipitate another financial crisis. So we are stuck in a vicious circle where nobody really wants to take the medicine. They're hoping that we can kick the can down the road and that things will get better over time. And to some extent, things were getting better because the banks are making an enormous amount of money right now. That's in some ways a good thing. But what's really bad is that if we hit another crisis, like a sovereign debt crisis in Europe, then all that stalling will be for naught.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what Andrea from Langhorn has to say. Andrea, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I was wondering if your guest could comment on the unintended consequence, one of the unintended consequences of the Dodd-Frank bill known as HVCC, and how it has affected homeowners and real estate appraisers like myself. I mean, I know how it's affected me, but I wondered if he had a comment on it.
I don't even know what HVCC
is. You're going to have to fill me in.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Okay, it's Home Valuation Code of Conduct, and what it's supposed to do is separate mortgage brokers from the appraisers who are doing appraisals. I can tell you what the effect has been on my business. It basically separated me from all the clients I had over the past, you know, 5 or 6 years, made it so that I could no longer do business with them. So, okay, that was negative to me, obviously. For homeowners, what they do, the management companies have been created to separate the two entities, and they charge homeowners, I don't know, maybe double the cost of regular appraisal, pay the appraiser less, and keep the money for themselves. So I don't know if your guest is familiar with that.
And you are a real estate appraiser. Desi, are you familiar with that?
Yes.
I'm not, and it's very interesting. I'm sure that there are going to be unintended consequences. The idea behind it, as I understand it, was that the appraisers were in the pocket of the banks or the mortgage brokers, and so there was some collusion or implicit collusion where the appraisers would accept high valuations on properties. Maybe that properties were overvalued because the bank would accept that and give a mortgage that was too high to somebody, and the borrower could pay it for a little while, and then it would reset, or interest rates would go up, or there would be a problem, and then the borrower couldn't pay it anymore. So separating those two functions to have independent appraisals, real, true appraisals, it strikes me as a good thing. Now, if that means that the appraisal system is gamed in some further way, this is a problem. This is the essential problem of, all rules have unintended consequences, and if this is a pervasive problem, it may well be. I'm not familiar with it.
Andrea, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And again, you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. A couple minutes before we have to say goodbye, but looking at all the things that led to the financial collapse and obviously the economic fallout from that, do you have any confidence that we are constructing a system that can address that if and when it happens in the future?
No, I don't think that we really have addressed the problems in the financial system, because I don't think that we've dealt with the structural issues that made our system very vulnerable. We dealt with smaller specific issues that will be open to loopholes and being gamed. And so what we have is a financial system that may or may not be right now as vulnerable as it was. The reason it may not be is just purely psychological, that people are afraid to take risks. But the financial system may be vulnerable because we have, as Senator Kaufman said, giant organizations that are difficult to manage and got bigger throughout the financial crisis. And then the main thing was that the government largely protected bondholders and protected in every case trading partners with banks. And so they can go into any crisis in the future and say, boy, last time the government protected me, I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to worry about not being protected. And that was an enormous problem. That creates moral hazard. That creates people's, limits their risk aversion. It makes them risk tolerant. It makes them take bad risks.
Sure, because I think someone will come in and rescue
them out. Exactly.
Let me see what Mark from Exton has to say. Mark, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
My question is, without the large financial institutions, most companies that want to borrow, let's say $50 million or more for a line of credit, will not be able to borrow that money from a community bank. Typically, a community bank will only possibly come up with $5 million. So if you're a GlaxoSmithKline, a big employer in our region, and needs a $3 or $5 billion line of credit, where will they get that going forward?
Jesse?
Yeah, this is an argument that the banking system puts forward, which is we're dealing with large global multinationals, and so you need a large global multinational to service those businesses. And I don't buy that entirely. For instance, the Glaxos of the world need a huge loan like that. No one bank really wants to take that on, even if it's Citigroup or JP Morgan. So they'll syndicate that loan to lots of banks. And so lots of banks and investors will end up taking pieces of that loan. In that way, it's almost as if you had lots of small banks giving those pieces of those loans. So the same thing when a large company goes public. Now, certain back office services are helped by cash management things for global multinationals are helped by large multinational companies. But then there are companies that are focused on that, like State Street or Bank of America, focus on those things, and they're relatively small. So I don't see the inherent need for global banks, especially when they can cost us and our economy trillions of dollars in a financial crisis. But I think it's a slightly valid argument and needs to be addressed.
Fair enough. Mark, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Jesse Eisinger, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. He's a senior reporter for ProPublica covering Wall Street and finance. And I'll say again, I said it several times during the hour, he won a Pulitzer Prize this year for national reporting with Jake Bernstein for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices. And we began our conversation with former U.S. Senator from Delaware and Ted Kaufman talking about Dodd-Frank and financial reform. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.